and welcome to Food Stuff. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And today,
we're talking about aspics. You might remember we mentioned this in a listener mail that we read a couple episodes ago from Sierra. Thank you, Sierra, because it was such a wonderful discovery for me. I've never heard of these things. I laughed so hard. I was horrified.
Growing up watching a lot of Julia Child videos, I had definitely been exposed to that. And also my dad had a little bit of training in classical French cooking. So
if you haven't seen a picture of one of these things, look them up the literal second you get a chance, like the second. They're so strange and they're so funny.
Because what is an aspic?
Yes.
It's basically savory Jell-O.
Uh-huh.
Before you freak out, okay, have you ever enjoyed, say tonkatsu ramen or like a nice rich stock or like a bone broth kind of thing? Savory gelatin, aka aspic, is a chilled version of the same thing.
Right.
You take broth or stock or consomme, which is another term for clarified stock, and you jellify it, chill it, and mold it into decorative shapes, sometimes with meat or vegetables or hard-boiled eggs or whatever else you can imagine, put inside of it.
I am trying to hold back from laughing just hearing the description.
Okay, but like ideally the point of an aspic is that, you know, it phase changes at your body temperature, aka melts. So you wind up with this spoonful of cold, delicious broth on your tongue.
Mm-hmm.
They look ludicrous. They look absolutely just gross and very silly and wiggly.
Yeah.
And meaty.
Very meaty and vegetable-y.
Uh-huh. Olive-y sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, now you have to look them up if you haven't done it already.
And every gelatin mold that you can imagine has had an aspic in it at some point.
Definitely.
Probably some you can't imagine.
There were definitely some things I never would have imagined that I stumbled in.
Aspic jelly, or gelée if you're fancy, can also be used as a kind of decoration or like condiment for cold dishes. It can be like a flavorful, pretty topping that you put on top of pâtés or terrines, or you can use it as a thin, like brushed-on glaze on cold presentations of sliced meat or seafood to give them that nice sheen.
Oh, yes. You need the sheen.
You want all your food to be shiny.
Uh-huh.
Obviously. Sometimes the jelly part is basically inedible.
Oh, great.
Or at least very unpleasant. And is simply, in heavy scare quotes, a way to show off the time and money that you have at your disposal. Like putting a whole cooked salmon inside a purely decorative aspic mold.
Don't we all love having to dig through basically an inedible jelly to get to a whole cooked salmon?
That's what I do at all of my fancy parties, Annie. This is why I've never invited you. I didn't think you could handle it.
I promise to be less judgmental, but you have to invite me to one of these now. Now that I know about it, I have to go.
I guess so. In the middle of our research for this, by the way, a blogger slash YouTuber by the name of Emmy, as in Emmy made in Japan, had a post about spaghetti jello go viral, as I have been told the kids say these days.
Do they?
I guess. Spaghetti Jell-O is like a savory tomato-based Jell-O mold with SpaghettiOs in it, the way that she's made it anyway. You might have seen this video, and it basically counts as an aspic.
Yeah, it does. I did have a friend whose mom, she was notorious for her interesting cooking, we'll say. And one time I came over, and she said she had orange Jell-O with cabbage.
Huh.
I didn't try it. I didn't see it because of those words enough as a kid, I was like,
No.
But I guess maybe that was an aspic. Maybe she was offering me some form of an aspic.
It might have counted. Certainly growing up, my grandmother in Ohio would serve gelatin salads, would be like lime jello with maybe shredded carrots or something like that inside of it. And it was definitely a side salad.
Sure.
And it was definitely like sweet jello with carrots in it.
I love that people call them salads. That's one of my favorite things. We'll do anything to like sound healthy.
Yeah.
But really.
Yeah. I mean, if it's green.
Oh boy. Yep. That's what counts these days. And we laugh or maybe shudder at these now, but at one time they were reserved for the finest of the fine dining experience.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So let's look at the history of these things.
Yeah.
Aspics are relatively new kid on the block, but they might be older than you think. The first instances of aspics most likely go back to 18th century France. Yes, France. Like Lauren kind of mentioned in the beginning of the podcast.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was spoiler alert. Sorry.
She totally spoiled it.
Ugh.
The first instance of gelatin making didn't involve food at all. Instead, scraps and bones left over after an animal carcass had been picked clean would be boiled down to collagen that was then used as an adhesive for cave painting. Yeah. Good old Pliny mentions that Romans did a similar thing to produce strong fish glue. Yeah.
Gelatin, useful for many things. We'll get into some of that
yes.
in the science section later on.
Mm-hmm. Aspics were preceded by 14th century medieval savory gelatin dishes called jellies that were made with boiled pig feet and ears filtered through cloth.
I found one recipe by the name of a jelly of flesh.
That sounds so good.
Sounds so metal.
It does. It could be a band.
Yeah.
The molded shapes delighted the medieval eye, with the added bonus that the meats and produce inside the gelatin usually could prevent spoilage for a little longer.
By cutting off the air supply from oxygen-hungry bacteria.
Right.
The word jelly or gelatin may come, by the way, from the Latin gelata, meaning frozen, indicating that the liquid and anything that you put in it would be frozen in place.
Oh, also gelato.
Yeah, sure.
Recipes for other savory gelatin dishes use calves and sheep's feet instead of pigs.
Uh-huh. One calls for white wine, ginger, anise, cinnamon, pepper, nutmeg, mace, and saffron in the mix. And all of that would then be strained and poured over chopped hens and the meat from the cow and or sheep's feet. So fancy.
Sounds delightful.
And making these dishes was just a serious pain in the calf's foot. You'd have to boil the animal parts for several hours, then strain all of the solids out and let the remaining liquid settle for an entire day and night so that the fat would rise to the top for skimming. The remaining stuff was gelatin that could be reheated and then flavored and molded. There was also a specific dish I found called galantine.
Ah.
Galantine? No, it's spelled like Galentine's Day, but I think it's pronounced galantine. And it was made of a minced meat and other stuff that was pressed into sort of like a round loaf and then coated in this savory gelatin with a heady spice blend. It was popular enough that Chaucer mentions it in his Ballad to Rosamond. We got our compatriot Jonathan Strickland, who is an erstwhile student of Middle English, to read the original for us.
Nos never peak wallowed in galantine, as e in lova am wallowed and e wound.
In case you didn't catch all of that, it means something like, never was pike so imbued in galantine as I in love am imbued and wounded.
Wow. That's some serious stuff.
Chaucer was so thirsty. Oh, my goodness. Okay. If you want to hear more from Jonathan Strickland, by the way, you can catch him on the podcast Tech Stuff and also on the Facebook Live show called Game Changers on How Stuff Works Facebook page.
Yeah. Super fun. History of board games. People play board games.
Mm-hmm. Video games, all kinds of things.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Check them out. Thank you, Jonathan. Anyway, so these sorts of recipes pop up in upper-class cookbooks from all over Europe. The British Museum cookbook reports they were often decorated with edible gold and silver leaf to make them that much more extra showy.
Yes.
And these cold dishes might have been especially popular due to the theory of using food to balance humors, that whole concept of cool versus hot and wet versus dry that's going on in our bodies and in the universe around us. So cold dishes made with gelatin were recommended especially for people with hot and moist temperaments, like youth and adolescence or during torrid southern summers.
One of these days, we're going to do an episode on humors. I feel like they keep popping up.
Yeah.
And I'm not entirely sure.
Oh.
But I am interested in hot and moist temperaments. That's a great descriptor.
I think I've known a few people like that.
Oh, have you? I think we all do. Anyway, to please the Friday non-meat-eating Catholic crowd, chefs got the idea to boil some eels in the stock of a fish like cod. and also swim bladders to make Catholic-approved fish jellies.
Hmm.
That sounds very appetizing.
Oh, yeah. Meanwhile, in the late 1500s, a fellow sometimes called Europe's first celebrity chef wrote about his technique of using egg whites to help clarify stock for gelatin. That was Maestro Martino de Como, who was Italian, if you could not tell. And we'll talk more about that works also in our science section below.
Towards the end of the medieval era, the definition of jelly expanded to include sweets, some made with either pectin or the Russian-discovered isinglass, which was derived from beluga bladder sturgeons. That doesn't sound as fancy as isinglass.
Absolutely not. Rose water was a popular flavoring for these sweet jellies. And this was also about the time that the term flummery came into existence, which is usually reserved for sweet gelled dishes, but has sometimes been used to hold savory ingredients as well.
Flummery sounds like something you'd exclaim.
Flummery!
Exactly.
What flummery is this? The meaning of the word has expanded to mean something kind of like insubstantial and silly.
Okay, excellent. So, yeah. I might incorporate that.
Absolutely.
Apart from the Lord of the Rings sounding isinglass, there were a few other competitors of gelatin. In 1660 Japan, it was discovered that if you processed red seaweed, you could get kanten, a seaweed-based jelly that was especially popular in Asia. Europeans called it agar-agar, and Northern Europe also had a method for boiling Irish moss, or red seaweed, until they derived carrageenan? I've actually never known how to say that. Which they then used to thicken things up.
Other sources of jellification included hartshorn, which is made from the horns of deer, and ivory shavings.
Ooh.
Very, very fancy indeed.
Indeed. It wasn't until 1682 that gelatin technology took another leap with French mathematician Denis Papin's invention of the wonderfully named steam digester.
Steam digester?
Uh-huh. Hmm. This thing extracted gelatin after some serious animal bone boiling. The first industrial gelatin extracting didn't happen until 1818.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. 1789 marks the first time the word appeared written in English.
Aspic.
Yes.
Yes.
And at the time, it meant a cold dish of meat, fish, eggs, etc., set in molded jelly. The English got it from the French, but beyond that, the origins are kind of a mystery.
Yeah, aspic was also a French term at the time for a type of lavender, so maybe it got the name from lavender seasoning that was used in recipes. But some food historians and etymologists trace it to the Greek word aspis, which literally meant a round shield, but had become a name for snakes, especially ones with rounded hoods. And that's where we get the word asp from. The shield part would certainly make sense in terms of protecting food inside the jelly, or the snake part might refer to the bright colors that were used in these aspics, you know, colored with stuff like extracts of sandalwood for red, saffron for yellow, and boiled blood for black.
Ooh. In William Makepeace Thackeray's 1848 novel Vanity Fair, one of the characters, no spoilers, dies via an aspic of plover's eggs. Ooh.
Huh. Ugh.
Doesn't sound good.
The famous French dictionary Littré from around that time lists as cold as an aspic as a proverbial phrase.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of proverbs, the Brits apparently use one to this day that is set in aspic, which means something that's stubbornly gelled in its outdated ways.
Yes, and this was used in a recent headline about British politics.
Oh, it's great.
Still in use.
Love it. There was an amazing variety of fanciful aspics described in a cookbook from 1769 called The Experienced English Housekeeper by one Elizabeth Raffold. And she laid out just these spectacular jellies that were made with calf's foot stock clarified with egg whites. Picture, if you will. Whole pigeons roasted with sprigs of myrtle stuck in their beaks, encased in clear gelatin. Or a gelatin fish pond made with a large and small colored flummery fishes, also encased in clear gelatin. Or a hen's nest made out of shredded lemon peel, set in gelatin, filled with gelatin eggs molded in real eggshells or with molded gelatin chickens. I want to hang out with this lady.
She sounds fabulous.
Oh, so fabulous. But aspic's heyday had not yet arrived, and soon they would be propelled into culinary fame by one extra famous chef. But before we get to that, let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor. The person we have to thank for bringing aspics into the limelight.
Limelight?
Yes, it's a major foreshadowing pun. Was the famous 19th century chef, Antonin Carême, who we talked about for a decent bit during our French cuisine episode. He is also known as one of the first celebrity chefs.
Mm-hmm.
He adored these things.
Oh, yeah.
Oh. And to do it right, in his mind, you needed a calf's foot.
Yeah.
And that's because, as we said before, you had to boil it down, clarify it, set it. And because of the time involved, aspics were extremely expensive and enjoyed almost exclusively by the rich, acting as centerpieces on tables that overfloweth with decor, food, and drink. It was assumed that if you presented an aspic in such a manner, you must have a waitstaff who did all the work for you. And in Carême's terminology, he called this chauffoir, or cooked hot, served cold.
Chauffoir.
Yes. And like we mentioned in our French food episode, Carême was a chef under Napoleon, so the aspics he perfected were towering, multi-layered structures to behold, sometimes composing tableaux. His final cookbook, published posthumously, featured an entire chapter complete with diagrams on the mighty, extremely customizable aspic.
Oh, yeah, just these ribboned layers of different colors, and they looked like castles, and they had these turrets, and it was a lot.
Yes, they're pretty great. Look them up. The European Association of Luxury and Aspic made the journey across to the American colonies, where they were popular with rich southern plantation owners, and where they were probably made by slaves, and rich elite in New York. And you wouldn't believe who's popping up again, but Thomas Jefferson.
Oh, of course.
Of course. He combined French wine and the French aspic to offer guests at Monticello wine jellies. That sounds pretty lovely.
Yeah.
The Industrial Revolution brought the aspic to a wider audience with the invention of packaged gelatin.
Ooh.
Yes. In 1845, New York, glue manufacturer Peter Cooper patented a powdered mix of processed sugar, spices, eggs, and lemon he called the first dessert gelatin mix. However, in the words of jellogallery.org, it didn't really gel with the American public.
Oh.
They beat us to that one.
They did. It was, however, inexpensive, being that it was a byproduct of the meat industry, which gave enterprising folks the motivation to work with it. And meanwhile, aspic-based dishes never really went out of fashion in most of Europe. Victorians, for example, were mad about complex gelled dishes, like a foie gras set in bombshell gelatin molds decorated with ringlets stamped out of egg, set on beds of more gelatin and also artichokes. Part of the draw of these things is that they could be prepared a day ahead, leaving the day of the party for other business.
Oh, man. These sound so epic. A couple of years later, in 1897, Pearl B. Waite, who made cough syrups, added food coloring to the mix of, like, dry gelatin powder to create a product his wife suggested he call Jell-O.
Huh.
Yes, that Jell-O, which he patented that year. But 2 years later, he sold it to Genesee Food Company for $450, which is around about $11,000 of today's American dollars.
Which I guess isn't super shabby, unless you consider the empire that Jell-O is.
Mm-hmm. By 1900, Genesee Food Company was putting out pamphlets and short cookbooks complete with Jell-O recipes to increase demand. They weren't the only ones promoting Jell-O in the early 1900s either. Companies that manufactured chillers or refrigerators got in the game too. For instance, General Electric came out with a cookbook to help you get the most out of your new refrigerator. If you take a look at the salad section, yes, the salad section, a majority of them are aspics. And these ad campaigns were very successful. Jell-O and the aspic really took off in the United States. Housewives liked them because they were quick, cheap. The dessert ones even saved you sugar, increased the life of leftovers, and this was really important during the Great Depression. And yet they somehow managed to keep this sort of showstopper, luxurious reputation, in part due to the time it took for the gelatin to set. And also, they were one of the least messy things you could feed your kids.
Oh, along those lines, there's a book called Perfection Salad, written by food historian Laura Shapiro about women in cooking around the turn of the 20th century. And she writes that this concept of the cleanliness of food, literally and psychologically, was just a major motivator at the time, which we've previously discussed in various episodes about the rise of a clean eating culture promoted by people like Graham and Kellogg, the pure food craze. Mm-hmm. Shapiro wrote of the gelatin salad, "A salad at last in control of itself."
At last.
At last.
Jell-O did a good job of capitalizing on the 1906 Food and Drug Act, advertising its safety pouch, and using the word pure three times.
This act was prompted by Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, which is that infamous look into the realities of the meat industry.
Oof, it's a rough one, mm-hmm. but definitely worth reading.
Oh, yeah.
In 1908, Jell-O debuted the smash hit Jell-O Girl that hailed the product as all that was pure and innocent about childhood. Sugar, and thus Jell-O, was rationed during World War I, which put a damper on things, but the product came back swinging once the war was over, helped along by the Great Depression, and new flavor lime Jell-O. Apparently the flavor was so loved, entire cookbooks were devoted to it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man.
Another development that helped gelatin salad's popularity, that popularization of the electric refrigerator. Mm-hmm. By the end of the 1930s, about 60% of households in America had one, and they kept food cooler more consistently. The Oxford Encyclopedia of Food and Drink in America estimates that up to a third of all recipes printed in cookbooks at the time involved gelatin.
That's crazy. And Jell-O wasn't the only gelatin in the game. Charles Knox of Knox Unflavored Gelatin touted his product at the 1904 World's Fair. A year later, the Perfection Salad, the recipe, not the book, made its debut at a Knox-sponsored cooking contest in Pennsylvania. This aspic consisted of finely chopped cabbage, celery, and red pepper. It won third place, and in 1972, James Beard wrote that this aspic's triumph unleashed a demand for congealed salads that has grown alarmingly, particularly in the suburbs. These salads, it still feels weird to call them that, were perceived as a lady food.
So light and delicate.
Uh-huh. The title of Knox Gelatin Cookbook was Dainty Desserts for Dainty People.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a book marketed to us, Annie.
No, I don't think so. And yet they still held on to their higher status when during World War II, serving an aspic was kind of like saying to your friends, you could throw quite the dinner party or gathering, rations or no rations. And there was also an interesting social transition happening regarding the role of a good housewife. A 1950 survey asked women to report their thoughts on a housewife who brought instant coffee versus one who brewed coffee. The women did not go easy on the housewife who purchased the instant coffee, calling her lazy, disorganized, and a bad wife.
Ouch.
Yeah. At the same time, the time and cost efficiency of making instant and manufactured products, along with the rate of profit seen by the producers of these things during World War II, meant that they weren't going anywhere. A housewife needed to be efficient and thrifty, but also put time and effort into the meals she cooked, as it was seen as her role. If you just put Jell-O in a bowl, it wasn't viewed as cooking. So what do you do? Let's make this fancy-looking aspic cheaply and efficiently and hit all the checkboxes. The aesthetic was key.
Mm-hmm.
And this was done with other cheap processed foods as well. Think hot dogs being used to make pigs in a blanket, for example.
Sure.
At their height, there were all kinds of crazy recipes, like lime Jell-O with canned tuna.
Ugh.
And man, the terminology in the cookbooks. Words like sinkers and floaters.
Oh.
Ooh, yeah. Painting quite the image there. To make the gelatin less see-through, you'd add mayo or cream. And until the 1970s, you could buy savory Jell-O flavors like celery and Italian salad.
This is not a thing that I knew. And I'm horrified.
but kind of intrigued,
but
right?
Very, very intrigued. Oh, I wondered, I'm sure that you could reproduce this with some unflavored gelatin and your own seasonings at home.
I'm sure. That's worth an experiment for sure. And speaking of the 1970s, that's about the time the aspic bubble burst.
Huh.
Yep. What happened, you ask? Changing views on dieting and nutrition happened. For the last several years of their reign, aspics started skewing more and more towards dessert. And then there was this damaging sun-dried tomato fad.
Yeah, can't put a dried thing in a wet thing. Sure, that doesn't make sense.
No, women started working easier than gelatin microwave-friendly meals hit the shelves. It pretty much died out, save for parts of the Midwest and South. One of my favorite descriptions I came across when researching this called the aspect a culinary fossil and a ghost.
Ooh.
I know.
Oh, I know several chefs who are offended.
They would disagree strongly.
Yeah.
Obviously, Jell-O is still around. They retooled after the aspic's demise, quote unquote, marketing themselves as a snack or dessert option. I believe they called themselves the number one best-selling dessert in the world. I'll have to look into that more, but I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
There is one state where aspics of the savory variety remain very popular, Utah. Especially among the Mormon population. The state named it their state snack in 2001, and the region is sometimes called the Jell-O Belt.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
And aspic-like things have stuck around in Asian American cuisine, as a dumpling filling, for example.
Absolutely.
So that's kind of a roundup of this weird and wild history of aspics until now.
Yeah, and now we've got some of the science behind aspics for you. But first, we've got another quick word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor. Okay, so science-wise, there are two important factors in making an aspic that's both pretty and tasty. The gelling agent and the crystal clear soup stock. First, let's talk about the stock. Clarifying a cloudy stock into a translucent consommé is tricky. Some of the particles that make a stock cloudy are too tiny to effectively sift out with strainers or cheesecloth, although that is certainly your first step. But as Maestro Martino wrote in the 1500s, you can harness the power of electromagnetics to clarify your stock.
Whoa.
Well, he didn't quite say that. He said that you should beat egg whites and add them to simmering stock, but ultimately it's what he meant. Egg whites, as it turns out, contain a protein called albumin, which are positively charged molecules. Lots of the stuff floating in your stock is negatively charged. Positives and negatives attract, so all of that stuff sticks to the albumin particles in the egg whites. After a while, a sort of raft of detritus forms, and you can just skim it off, leaving a much clearer soup. You can also use gelatin or other products that work in a similar electromagnetic way to achieve a clear consommé. And the technique has also been used in winemaking since the 1600s at least. It created such a surplus of egg yolks in Bordeaux that it started a specialty pastry trade there. And we will have to come back to this later because it's great.
Absolutely.
Okay. There's a lot of discussion, by the way, among chefs about how to create the most flavorful yet the most transparent consommé. Way too much to go into here. Those are the basics. Now, that gelling agent. As we talked about in our marshmallow episode, gelatin is a really useful thing in food chemistry because it solidifies at around 95 degrees Fahrenheit, aka 35 degrees Celsius, and it melts at anything above that, which is why things like Jell-O melt in your mouth, thus delivering flavor directly to your tongue. Gelatin is a protein, and it's made up of these long, friendly chains of amino acids. By friendly, I mean that they're super willing to bond up into complex matrices at room temperature, and they are also happy to form bonds with water molecules. Gelatin chains can have hundreds of hydrogen atoms sticking out along their sides, each of which can bond weakly with a water molecule when the temperature is cool enough. So what happens is you add gelatin to warm water, and the warmth makes all the gelatin molecules slip and slide and wiggle apart from each other. As they cool, they chill out, literally, and they grab up some water molecules and they cling together in these complex patterns, trapping the water among themselves. Jell-O mold. If you warm it up again, say in your mouth, all of those molecules start sliding away from each other again. Gelatin itself is flavorless, but anything soluble in water, flavorings and colorings, will come along for the ride.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. You get gelatin by breaking down collagen, which is even longer chains of amino acids. They're all twined up together. Collagen is a connective protein in and around cells that gives them a flexible structure. It makes up about 30% of your body weight, actually, and it's especially prevalent in skin and tendons and bones, which is why feet are so effective in making these gelatin stocks, because they've got all these tendons and lots of surface area of the bones and the skin, so you've got plenty of opportunity to leach the collagens out. So when you boil these tissues, the collagen inside them untwines, leaving you with gelatin molecules. And what's happening when you cool the gelatin down is the molecules are sort of trying to reform those twiny collagen patterns and sort of failing, but failing deliciously.
It's the best way to fail.
Mm-hmm. These days, many chefs might prepare their aspics with packaged gelatin or with vegetarian alternatives like seaweed extracts. But purists will tell you that you really do need to boil some animal feet. And gelatin may carry health benefits.
Ooh.
When gelatin supplements are taken with vitamin C, they've sometimes been shown to improve patients' blood levels of the markers of collagen synthesis to help, like, repair bones and keep your teeth and skin healthy, stuff like that, sure. And gelatin is certainly a source of protein, but mostly you should eat it if you like it.
Yeah. I have to say I've got a newfound respect for gelatin now. There's a lot of very interesting science right there.
I know. I love it.
Right. So in case we haven't convinced you that you need to look up some pictures of these things, here are some of the best aspic titles we stumbled upon. And I think the title's enough will be enough to pique your curiosity.
I hope so.
Okay. Yeah.
All right.
A lot of them sound like modern art pieces to me.
Oh, I know.
So there's a lime cheese salad, tuna and jello pie. Super salad loaf, a recipe courtesy of Hellman's Mayo. This involved stuffing an empty bologna shell with the jelly of mashed peas and heaping with mayo. And also, you got bonus points for adding radish roses.
Oh, radish roses were everywhere in these things.
Yes.
Along those lines, molded mayonnaise salad, mostly cheese and mayo.
Snowy chicken confetti salad, emerald cantaloupe, jellied lamb salad, sauerkraut mold, prune and stuffed roast pork, bean and mushroom salad, lemony salmon tower, pressed ox tongue. So that'll, I mean, surely you're hungry by now.
Oh.
Surely.
You've got to be.
Absolutely.
Oh, well, that just about brings us to our listener mail.
Yes. Our first letter is in response to our Chuck E. Cheese episode. Katie sent us, in 2014 on Halloween, I attended my friend's mom's wedding at a Chuck E. Cheese. We all dressed up and an Elvis impersonator was in charge of the wedding service.
Wow.
The bride and groom even went into the ticket window tunnel to grab tickets together. It was quite possibly the weirdest wedding that I've been to. During your latest episode, I had flashbacks to that time, and I thought you two would enjoy reading about it. Attached is a group picture from the event. I hope you all in the studio have a wonderful week. The picture was lovely. I think that would be a fun wedding to attend, personally. It would be strange and very memorable.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Well, memorable is great. Come on. You want to be original?
Yeah.
Also, about our Chuck E. Cheese episode, Lisa wrote, when our daughters were younger, around 4 and 6 years old, the show they watched on PBS was sponsored by Chuck E. Cheese. They would often ask to go, but it never had any appeal to my husband or me. One snowy Michigan spring Sunday afternoon, my husband found a coupon to the Chuck E. Cheese about 45 minutes away. As a surprise, we took our girls for pizza and games. They had a blast. On the way home, they asked when we could go back. Out of nowhere, self-preservation, I assume, I told them that unfortunately, to give all the children a turn, every child in the world is only allowed one visit to Chuck E. Cheese. We should be happy we finally had our turn and cherish the fun we had. They completely bought this story and didn't call me out on it until a couple years ago. They're now 10 and 12. That's magical.
Yes. I believe she said parenting win, smiley face, after that. That's wonderful. And I have to say, thank you to all the listeners who have been sending us the Chuck E. Cheese YouTube videos.
Yes.
With like pop and rap music.
Yeah.
The band performing pop and rap music.
Right, right. That people have set up in their own homes, I think. And just set it to, right, set the machinery to play along to amazing hip hop.
Yeah, like In the Club by Usher.
Yeah.
Very enjoyable and bizarre.
I've retweeted at least one of those.
Yeah.
It's not, like I said on Twitter, y'all, like, it's not necessarily not safe for work, but it's a little bit, like, not safe for sanity or humanity.
Yeah.
Whew. It's a bunch. But I recommend checking it out if you think that you would even be a little bit interested in that.
Absolutely. And if you would like to do as these listeners have done and write to us, you can. We have an email address. It's foodstuff@howstuffworks.com.
We are also on Facebook and Twitter @foodstuffhsw and on Instagram @foodstuff. Shout out to our sound engineer, Alexander Williams.
I got
his name right. That's excellent. We hope to hear from you, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.